Thanks for listening to A Little More Conversation. I'm Ben O'Hara Byrne on this Thursday night. It wasn't long after those terrifying images of the Baltimore Bridge disaster started to emerge on social media that the same social media was flooded with conspiracy theories about what had gone wrong. So why is it that so many people with influence online and political commentators are so eager to jump in and exploit tragedies? We find out. The Prime Minister is promising to help out beleaguered renters in Canada in the April 16th federal budget, teasing a bunch of measures in Vancouver this week, including something he's calling a renter's bill of rights. So is it feasible and will it actually do any good? Environment and Climate Change Minister Stephen Guilbeault is with me just days before that scheduled 23% hike of the carbon tax on Monday, April 1st. His government has been under intense pressure, including from provincial premiers, to pause the hike given the affordability crisis. So why won't they? He explains. But first, he is the undisputed king of TV show themes. Grammy and Emmy Award winner Mike Post has created such unforgettable riffs as The Rockford Files, Magnum P.I., Hill Street Blues, and Law & Order. The list goes on and on and on. He's with me to talk about his incredible career and a new album he has coming out on April the 5th. This is someone I've been wanting to speak to for a very long time. It just happened to work out this week because he has a new album coming out next week. He is the undisputed king of TV theme songs. Over more than 50 years, Mike Post has composed dozens of riffs for some of the most popular and critically acclaimed shows ever. He's won multiple Grammys and Emmys and scored 5 top 10 hits. Now, he grew up in Burbank, California, right in the heart of a burgeoning entertainment industry. So he first made his name as a studio musician, part of the legendary cabal of famous studio musicians called the Wrecking Crew. He even played as a teenager on Sonny and Cher's smash, I Got You, Babe.
I got you, babe. I got you, babe. They say our love won't pay the rent, for it's earned, our money's all been spent.
There he is, just a teenager playing on all those Sonny and Cher records, by the way. Barely out of his teens, he would then develop and produce a band called First Edition, featuring a then unknown Kenny Rogers.
I woke up this morning with the sundown shining in. I found my mind in a brown paper bag, but then I tripped on a cloud and fell 8 miles high. I tore my mind.
Barely out of his teens, he'd already done all this incredible stuff. Then at 24, he'd go on to become the youngest musical director of any show in Hollywood, working on The Andy Williams Show. But it would be a chance encounter and friendship with TV writer and producer Stephen J. Cannell that would set him on what would be his path, first composing the theme to 1973's Toma before hitting the charts and hitting the big time with The Rockford Files. And his credits since then read like a page out of TV history. He composed the themes to Hill Street Blues, Magnum P.I., The A-Team, Greatest American Hero, NYPD Blue, Quantum Leap, the list goes on and on and on, and of course, one that's been with us now for more than 30 years, Law & Order. Now, what's amazing when you listen to his themes is that they're always just a bit funkier than you'd expect. There's always like that little guitar twang in Law & Order. When you listen to the album that he put out now and listen to where he came from, you can see where that kind of bluesy, bit funky thing came from. But ironically, and this was because Dick Wolf, the producer of the show and creator of the show, asked him to do this as a favor, perhaps his most famous thing is simply 2 very, very iconic notes. Have a listen. That's right. He wrote that. He has publishing rights to that sound. Let's listen to it again. Mike Post, ladies and gentlemen. So not only did he write all those themes, he also wrote that. Now he has a new album coming out, his first album of original material in many, many years. It's a tribute to his first musical loves, bluegrass and blues, as I mentioned. He considers himself an aficionado of American music. It's called Message from the Mountains and Echoes of the Delta. So the mountains being the bluegrass, the delta being the blues. It's out on Sony Masterworks a week tomorrow, April the 5th. But it is my great pleasure to welcome Mike Post to the show tonight. Mike, thank you.
I'm so happy to be here. Thank you, Ben.
I really enjoyed, knowing your themes, knowing your music, and knowing sort of the roots of where it all came from. Listening to this new album is really interesting because it feels like a journey in many ways, but it also feels not just a journey through American music, but kind of a journey through your musical career as well. There's a lot, you hear a lot of your influences throughout this album.
Yes, you know, this thing came about because of COVID in that the shows I was working on at the time were all sort of on hiatus and like, okay, we can't go about our normal game plan of doing numerous shows every week. Okay, so I'm thinking, all right, well, I can practice. You know, I can certainly sit down and get better at guitar playing or piano playing or something. You know, I can listen to some new music. I'm driving along in a car, and I just happened to be on my way on a two-hour little trip, and I'm down a Spotify hole. And I'm listening to some bluegrass that I hadn't heard before and then some that I had heard. And their algorithm is so smart, it just takes you to such neat places. And I just had this idea. I said, well, you know, I wonder if anybody's ever done a concert piece with a bluegrass rhythm section and an orchestra, you know? I said, I don't think anybody's ever done that. And I thought, well, that would be really difficult. That would be really hard to do, wouldn't it? Well, let me think. How would you do that? You know, especially when you can't put an orchestra together. I just, the idea started that way. And then I thought, wait a second, there's a way to do this. And, I went home and I got my drafting board out and I started writing the old way, you know, no computer in sight, you know, just a pencil and some score paper. And let's get busy with some little sort of chunks, little pieces. Both pieces sort of coagulated at kind of at the same time. And it was really fun to do. Difficult, took me a long time, but it was really fun to do.
It's amazing, too, to look at who's playing on this, because for people who don't know, of course, Mike, you sort of made your, not didn't get your start, but one of the first things you did that was, you know, sort of got you into this bigger world of music was session playing. And there's such a great bunch of session musicians on this album. And it really did sort of harken back to your time with the Wrecking Crew and so on. And, you know, where you got your start, this incredible talent that's out there that are available to play on an album like this one.
Yeah. You know, honestly, Ben, you're never going to interview a more fortunate person than me. You know, I didn't have to come from Calgary or Des Moines or Vermont. I was here in LA when I was committed to a life in music. So I didn't have to go very far. That's number one. Number two, I was surrounded and had influences by what I believe to be the largest set of super talented musicians that were also inhabited, that also inhabited this a personality trait of gunfighters. I mean, we're all gunfighters. That's what we are. That's who the Wrecking Crew really was. It's like, no, well, how much did you rehearse? We didn't. We just walked into rooms and sat down and went, okay, let's go. You know, and it's like, wow. You know, I mean, that should have scared the living hell out of everybody. And the truth is, it was invigorating and it was normal. And it was, you know, I think I played on my first record when I was 16. And I mean, I just went, oh, this is great. This is, I'd rather be here than in the clubs playing, you know, and I'd rather be playing music that I hadn't heard before than playing Proud Mary again. You know, I mean, this is fun. And then I got to sit next to, as you said, you know, all these guys, you know, from Barney Kessel to Howard Roberts to Tommy Tedesco to Glenn Campbell to, you know, James Burton and, you know, all these great guitar players, to say nothing of it at every other position. The level of musicianship was just, God, just unbelievable. And then to transition from being one of them to going on the other side of the glass and being able to write the arrangements and then write the music itself, that, you know, in film television, it's like, man, to get to work with players this great. So when it came time to make this record, I just drew on the experience of all those years as a player and then as an arranger and a producer and a composer. I said, well, let's get the boys, you know, let's get the boys
let's
and
get
girls.
The gunslingers. Let's get the gunslingers together. It's amazing. If people actually look back at your career, I think everyone knows I Got You, Babe. You're on that, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Actually, that was the first big hit record I played on. You know, I played on all Sonny and Cher's hits and Cher's hits. And I worked for anybody. I worked for everybody. And then my musical ambition took over. You know, the first 6 months I wouldn't say I was scared, but I was certainly hyper-focused. I go, okay, don't screw this up. You're with the big boys. But after 6 months, then I had this addiction to ambition of like, wait a second, that isn't what the bass line ought to be. The strings ought to be playing, you know. And I surprised myself. I kind of went, who do you think you are? You know, and I said, well, I really would like to a chance at the architecture, at the engineering of it from a structural standpoint musically. And once I did my first arranging and all, I quickly found that I needed to be a producer as well in order to protect the music I was writing, you know. So I covered both sides of the street early on. And then, honestly, the most fortunate guy you'll ever meet, because it just all came together in such perfect timing that I was never bored. I was never really all that stressed. I just got opportunity after opportunity, and I mostly was successful at it. And so more opportunities opened up. It was crazy.
Mike Post is with us, the man behind some of the greatest TV themes you'll have ever heard. Some of the most iconic, of course. Mike, it's interesting that you had, I guess it was a chance encounter with Stephen J. Cannell, who ended up being an incredibly successful writer and TV producer. And it wasn't your first one that you wrote for him, but the Rockford Files. I have to tell you, I used to watch the show with my grandmother, and my parents were big into music, so I had a lot of music in the house. But the theme to the Rockford Files was the first song that I considered to be a song that I liked. It's funny to think back all those years ago, but what an interesting piece of music if you listen to it now, because there's an instrument that features on your new album as well called the dobro, which I'd never heard of. And there it is on the Rockford Files theme.
Indeed. Yeah. So when Cannell first called me up to tell me the story, you know, he was just my best friend and, you know, just the greatest guy in the world. He would tell me stories and he would speak in producer terms. And my job was to be the code breaker to figure out, you know, how to make music out of that, you know. And when I was working with my partner, Pete Carpenter at the time, my late partner, who, if he were alive, I'd still have a partner. When Steve told us the story, he said, look, he said, here's this idea. He said, this guy gets wrongfully convicted of a felony and he goes to jail, big time jail. But then he gets exonerated. New evidence comes to light and he gets out. And he's a really good looking guy and he drives a Firebird and he lives in a house trailer down in Malibu.
Wow, that's detailed.
Actually, specifically for those that have been to Southern California, he lived in Paradise Cove. Well, only went there like every day of the summer to go to the beach. So I go, well, okay, this sounds great. What else? Well, he's got a dad who's a truck driver. Okay, we're kind of retired. And he's a private investigator. Okay. He said, but he's big and he's athletic and all, but he doesn't really want to get in any fights. He doesn't want to get in any danger. He's more interested in his $200 a day plus expenses. I went, wow, okay. And I'm starting to think, okay, Southern California, the beach. Okay, I'm starting to, it's the Beach Boys, guys. Okay. And Cannell said, and I said, well, what's the casting? He said, well, I'm trying for Jim Garner. I went, oh, so it's not Southern California. It's a little Southern, you know? He goes, yeah, there's something about it. He said, but it's real different. He doesn't talk in a heavy Southern drawl. He's just Southwestern. I said, like Jim is Tulsa, Oklahoma. Okay, great. I got it, you know? So I started thinking, how about harmonica, Pete? Pete goes, harmonica would be great. You know, blues harmonica, that just hasn't happened. You know, nobody's done that. And I said, well, all right, what else? Hey, you know, I just got this little keyboard thing called a mini Moog and nobody's really used it, you know, as a lead instrument yet, But I like this one little setting on it that's kind of weepy and kind of odd, you know. And I said, you know, what do you think? And he goes, well, with a small orchestra with it? I said, exactly. We'll just mix and match, you know. We'll try and do something a little different. Sam Phillips, the father, in my opinion, of Southern rock, the father of maybe of rockabilly, if not everything, the guy that discovered, you know, Elvis Presley and Johnny Cash and, you know, legendary guy, Jerry Lee Lewis, all the rest, Carl Perkins. Sam Phillips said, and I'm paraphrasing, he said, if you ain't doing something different, you ain't doing nothing at all. You know, so, you know, that's what I've always tried to do is with these themes, especially, and the score underscore as well, is to take the schematic that Henry Mancini made, which was, I'm going to be tuneful. And he was tuneful in a jazz way, right? He was tuneful in a kind of big band way, in a jazz way. Well, that's what he came out of. What did I come out of? I came out of rock, folk, blues, you know. Okay, so I'm just trying to follow his trail, which was, hey, let him walk out humming the thing. That's what I did when you heard Rockford. Okay, when I heard Peter Gunn, I went, oh, my taste is on TV now, you know.
The one-minute hit, you called them.
That's exactly right. Try and write a one-minute hit record, you know. So I've heard them described as earworms. I've heard them described as, you know, those catchy little tunes you write. Okay, whatever. You know, I'm just trying to service the picture. So when Cannell told me a story, we just tried to, what would that guy write if he could write music? You know, he could damn sure write scripts, you know. What would he write if he could write music?
Mike Post, the great TV theme composer, amongst many other things, I don't want to sell him short here, is with us this hour. We're talking about his new album called Message from the Mountains and Echoes of the Delta, which is out a week from tomorrow on Sony Masterworks, April the 5th, and some of the incredible themes. The one that always stood out to me, Mike, was obviously Hill Street Blues, because my dad was a big fan of the show. It's a gritty New York cop show, and yet the song, the theme to it, with Larry Carlton, who you've used on others, who's an incredible session musician, is so counterintuitive to the show itself. And it was such a big hit. And I understand that you came up with it pretty quickly.
Yeah, almost instantaneous. Bochco had an office at CBS Studio Center. I lived exactly as a crow flies, a half mile, three quarters of a mile from it. And so I went over and saw the pilot, and I was just blown away. It's 1980, I guess. And just absolutely never seen television like this. Just different, really different. And there was no main title sequence. It was just the body of the show. So we went up to Bochco's office, and a few of us are sitting around talking, Bochco, another writer, and Gray Hoplin, the director, and myself. And so I'm just almost speechless going, Jesus, Stephen, this is so good. I can't believe it. It's just so different and so good. He goes, well, what's it sound like? I said, well, what am I looking at during the main title? And Hoblit said, the way I'm seeing it is the garage door goes up on a police garage, and out comes this prowler car, and it starts going through these bombed out, burnt out, drizzly, snowy, winter, cold South Bronx, but it could be any Eastern city. It could be Detroit. It could be Chicago. It could be Midwestern, Cleveland, you know, all the above. But it's really desolate. And I said, okay. Bochco says, what's that sound like? I said, well, it could be funky. You know, it could be like Stevie Wonder, clavinet. The thing about your pilot is that it's so soulful. It has these incredibly funny parts. It has these incredibly sad parts. It has these dangerous parts. It has these like really in your face parts, but it's still human. And I said, you know, I guess I could write a piece of music where you just kind of just shake your head and go, wow, you know, the clock's just going to keep ticking, and babies are going to get born, and people are going to get killed, and, you know, and all the human ups and downs. It's just, wow. And he goes, yeah, why don't you do that? I said, well, I could go against the picture that way and sort of do something with some poignancy. And he goes, yeah, try that. So I went right home. It took me, you know, 4 minutes to get home, and I didn't have anything else to do. So I went to my studio, and I'm The minute my hands were on the piano, I was in E flat for some reason. And I just went, I went, wow, wait a minute. That's actually pretty good, you know? And I get a B section and kind of odd modulation and it went a weird place and took me about 30 minutes. I don't even know that I wrote it down. I think I just kind of played it and memorized it. And so I called Bochco back up and I said, hey, you better come over here. He goes, no, I don't want something out of a trunk that you wrote for. I said, Stephen, I don't have a trunk. I've never done that. I just react. And he goes, you mean you just wrote this? I went, yeah, I swear to God I did. So he and Hoblit came over and they walked in the door and I said, all right. And he just had this weird look on his face. He went, play that again. I played it again. And Hoblit started to say something. Bochco put his hand up and he looked at me. He goes, kid, that's my show. That is my show. Wow. That's exactly my show. Don't change it. I want you to play every note of it on that piano. I said, no, Stephen, stop it. We're going to go in the studio. It's going to be a small rhythm section. There's going to be more to it than this. Small strings section, you know, just rhythm section, string section, maybe a guitar thing in there some kind of way. You know, he went, okay, but don't change anything, please. I said, I promise you, I won't. So that's the way it happened.
Incredible. Did you know it was going to be a hit? Because it was a hit. And even at the time, there were more instrumentals on radio than there are perhaps in years after that. Yes. But did you know it was going to be a hit?
Well, I hoped. I hoped that it maybe had some legs outside of the show. That's the hope every time, you know, because I was trying to take a page out of the Mancini book, you know, with Peter Gunn and Mr. Lucky and Moon River. And, you know, that's what he did. You know, the Hank was... He was the guy for that. So, but you know, the show almost didn't make it, and then it did, and then it became really successful. And then I guess within the first season, people started talking about how much they liked the theme. So I thought, well, I better go make a record. I better make a record, you know. Yeah. So
it's interesting because when one thinks of those shows, one often thinks of your themes like the Rockford Files, and we'll talk Magnum in a second, but it's always hard to tell. I guess it all comes together, right? I mean, often people think the theme really helped make the show because it begins the show, so you know it and it's familiar, but you know, the show has to be good too. So it's kind of a chicken and egg thing, right? With the themes, you've written themes for lots of great shows, but lots of shows became a little bit better because they had really good themes.
Oh, thank you. Look, on those of us on this side of the glass and this side of the desk and this side of the television, you know, anybody tells you they know, they're so full of it. You know, I mean, we don't know. Bochco didn't know. I didn't know. You know, we're just, hey, maybe it ought to be this, you know, maybe he ought to say this and maybe she ought to do this. And, you know, and maybe I ought to play that. I've always felt like my job was they bring me their art and I put my art with it and the whole thing's more artistic. You know, that's the hope. And you mentioned that they work together hand in hand. Well, that's what's supposed to happen, you know, in a collaboration. That's what's supposed to happen in this conversation. But, you know, it's a conversation between literary, filmatic music, filmatic art and music art, right? And now they go together and they go, well, God, you know, you just enhance the drama or the comedy or the tragedy of it, you know. Well, that's my job, you know, that's just what I'm supposed to do. So
Mike Post is with us this hour. His new album is called Message from the Mountains and Echoes of the Delta. It's out on Sony Masterworks a week tomorrow on April the 5th. It really is a great musical journey. It's both bluegrass with an orchestra and blues with an orchestra, two big influences on Mike's musical life as well. And if you listen to his themes, you can hear those influences. If you listen to the album and then you listen back to the themes, a lot of the things, you can hear a lot of the influences that, you know, that have lasted with him throughout the years and the kind of instrumentation and so on. I suppose, Mike, we can't not talk about Law and Order because it has become, it's still with us. I mean, if there is a more recognizable TV theme out there, I don't know what it is, but it's really interesting how it came about, especially the infamous bum bum, which of course you wrote. which people may not know. But wow, Law and Order has really been, I wouldn't say it is a game changer because you were already there, but wow, what a run on that show.
When I first partnered up with Pete Carpenter, you know, he was a, sort of a legit jazz guy, and I'm this rock and roller that could read and write and orchestrate and conduct, right? You know, he was a couple of years older than my father, yet it felt like he really was my buddy, you know, was my dear, dear close friend. And we worked together for 17 years, and we wrote close to 2,000 hours worth of television to get television music together. In those 17 years, we never had an unkind word between us, never had an argument. We just had fun, and we did reams of music. But then, you know, he got ill, and he had to sit down for a while. And then I started working alone. Law and Order, I have to tell you, when I'm done speaking to you today, I'm going to walk into the control room part of my studio here, and I'm going to do yet another episode of SVU. But I'm really looking forward to going in there because the picture is really good. Mariska directed it. I'm excited to be working on something I've been doing 30 some odd years. And I'm going, it's such a good show. And it's you know, it's changed over the years. The music's changed over the years. The theme's still pretty much the same. The ding, ding, dong, dong, ching, ching, whatever the hell you call it.
You need to tell me that story because that is the coolest Dick Wolf Mike Post story about how that came about.
Okay, so Dick Wolf, dear friend of mine since he was a writer on Hill Street. Okay, so we know each other a long time. He sends me the script on his pilot, you know, and it's just terrific. He shoots the pilot. I do the music. He's thrilled to death. So I'm figuring, okay, check that box. Okay, next project. I'm working on something else. He calls me from the dub stage on the third day of the dub, and there's a 4-day dub, so it's almost done. I said, hey, is the music all sounding good yet? Oh, no, love it. Look, God, it's just great. Love it. I said, oh, well, what's up? He said, well, I need a favor. I said, well, sure. What's up? What do you need? He goes, so I've decided to date stamp scene changes most of the time. I said, well, that's interesting. It'll make it even more documentary sort of. And he goes, yep. I said, oh, good. And he says, so I need something different. I need a sound effect for that, for the scene changes. I said, oh, wonderful. Well, call sound effects because I'm your composer. I don't do sounds. I do music, Dick. He goes, oh, come on. I said, no. I'm no kidding. Just call up sound effects. I don't mess with that. And I'm done with your project. He goes, Jesus, why do you have to bust my balls this way? Can you just help me out? I went, oh, you're ridiculous. All right, I'll call you back. Now, I know I only got 24 hours to figure something out, you know, so a young fellow was working with me named Danny Lux, genius and a great TV composer in his own right now, Grey's Anatomy, so on and so forth. And we start looking for samples. We find a jail door slamming, a guy hitting an anvil with a hammer, a bunch of men in Japan stomping on a wood floor, but various. And then we bang on some drums and we do some other stuff. And we finally get, after 6 or 7 hours worth of messing around with this, we finally get this sound. So I send it over to the dub stage. She calls me, it's perfect. It's exactly what I want. I went, okay, all right. Now I'm going, he's out of his mind. About 4 or 5 years later, I get a note from him. He goes, after all the great music you've written, all the shows you've done, isn't it funny that on your tombstone will be two notes that aren't even notes, they're sound effects?
Yeah, dum dum. I mean, life is funny. Although I always think back when I was prepping for this interview, Dolly Parton, who you produced her 9 to 5 album many years ago, said you had the best job in music because you had all the fun and none of the hassle. And just listening to you, I get the impression that that might have been long ago, but she was bang on.
Yeah, you know, I'm sitting at a dinner one time in Hawaii with Tom Selleck, who I went to grammar school, junior high, and high school with, and Dolly, and some friends. And we're in a very upscale, nice restaurant. And still in all, people, and we're in a corner, but people just can't stop staring, and some come over for autographs and this and that. And about, oh, maybe three quarters of the way through the dinner, she's just looking at me and smirking, and I could tell, and she's a bit, you know, there's no better person ever born than Dolly. And she looks at Tom and she goes, did you like him in school? He goes, well, he was bigger than me, first of all, because I was this big when I was 11, and he wasn't. He was a skinny kid. And he said, yeah, he was big for his age, always, until he wasn't, you know, until we all grew around him. He said, so, you know, we played sports together and everything else. He said, but, you know, and he wasn't afraid of girls. And I was always afraid of girls. I was, you know, and he was annoying right from the beginning. She goes, you know what we're talking about? I said, yeah, I know what you're talking about. But you guys wanted to be stars from the beginning. Huh. And she goes, yeah. I said, so you picked your poison, and I've got it pretty good because I have all the good parts of it, but none of the bad parts. You know, I get to walk into rooms full of musicians or rooms with a few musicians, and they always turn and look at me and go, how do you want this to sound? And that's a pretty good life, you know?
Even better. Mike, congratulations on the album. It's called Message from the Mountains and Echoes of the Delta. It's out on Sony Masterworks a week from tomorrow, April the 5th. Thank you so much for your time tonight.
Oh, it's so nice talking to you, Ben. I hope it was good for you because it was great for me.
And as we head into this Easter long weekend, a lot of people have already been spending weeks looking ahead to Monday. April the 1st is more than just April Fool's Day this year. Of course, it ushers in some new taxes. And the center of attention has been, for weeks, that scheduled 23% increase of the federal carbon tax, other than in BC, where its own carbon tax will also rise, and in Quebec, where it has its own program. So anywhere else, it goes up on Monday. Apparently, it'll add about 3 cents per liter of gasoline, 3 cents more to the price. There's also a gasoline hike coming up in Alberta as well, so that'll be pretty painful, I think, if it hasn't already happened. There has been a very vocal campaign that I'm sure you're probably aware of to get the federal Liberal government to reconsider the hike. Opposition leader Pierre Poilievre has been touring the country with his axe attacks rallies, of course, demanding it be done away with altogether. Seven provincial premiers, including the Liberal premier of Newfoundland and Labrador, Andrew Fury, have been demanding the same, or at least a temporary pause to scrap this hike that's coming up in a few days. They insist, despite rebates given to 80% of those under the federal scheme, according to the government, that it is unfairly and unnecessarily making the current affordability crisis worse. Now, Alberta Premier Danielle Smith and New Brunswick's Premier Blaine Higgs appeared before a parliamentary committee today, following on the heels of Saskatchewan's Scott Moe, who appeared yesterday. And Danielle Smith made her case. Have a listen.
Albertans and all Canadians need common sense, compassion, and responsible government to prevail. That's why I'm urging you today to heed the calls of Canadians across the country and suspend the increase in the carbon tax on April 1st. The carbon tax has contributed to and worsened Canadian stress and financial pain, despite the federal government's claims that Canadians benefit from rebates.
Now, of course, the numbers around this have been thrown around. I mean, it's hard to make sense of any of it, right? Both opponents of it quote the parliamentary budget officer, and the government quotes the parliamentary budget officer. A bunch of economists came out this week, wrote an open letter saying, listen, it's the most effective way to reduce carbon emissions. And there are checks going back to people. But I think a lot of folks are saying, well, wait a second, we put the money up front. So whether we get the rebates, you know, when we get the rebates, we're already putting money. Then, of course, there's the whole argument about how the carbon tax filters through the system. But policy aside, the arguments against it certainly are resonating with a whole bunch of Canadians right now. Polling shows that most agree. This is according to a new Angus Reid poll. There was one out earlier this month, that was commissioned by the Canadian Taxpayers Federation that pretty much found the same stuff. 40% of those surveyed say that the carbon tax is making their life a lot more expensive. Not just more expensive, a lot more expensive. Another 26% say it's making things a little more expensive. So add that together, that's two-thirds of Canadians. 68% of people say it's not effective in fighting greenhouse gas emissions. Now, it is fairly effective at doing that, but it takes a long time, right? So it's not an overnight success thing. And 56%, and this is a really key one, 56% of people say that cost of living concerns should outweigh climate concerns right now when crafting economic policy. And here's the problem for the Liberals. It doesn't matter whether they've done a bad job of explaining this or whether many Canadians do in fact get a rebate that make up for some of what a lot of what they're being charged on this carbon tax. You know, fighting climate change needs to be a communal thing. We all have to kind of agree on how it works. And when something starts to lose its legitimacy, the way this has, well, then you should really go back to the drawing board to some extent. I know it's not easy. It's kind of their signature policy. But after the carve out last year in the fall for home heating oil, it did indicate that they were aware that this could have an impact, an unfair impact to some extent, on Canadians who have to pay it. So why won't they budge on this one? Why won't they budge, considering the backlash? Well, who better to ask than Stephen Guilbeau? He is the Federal Minister of Environment and Climate Change, and he joins me now. Minister, thanks for your time tonight.
My pleasure, Ben.
April 1st approaches quickly. In fact, we're heading into a holiday weekend, so it's nearly upon us. There's been lots of speculation that there could be some softening or some changes ahead of this planned increase to the carbon tax. How likely is that to happen?
I'd say very, very unlikely. The Prime Minister has been very clear. They will be no more changes to the pricing on pollution in Canada. And we are moving ahead with this very important piece of policy to help us tackle climate change pollution in Canada.
You certainly heard the appeals. They've been loud. They've been plenty from both the leader of the opposition, premiers, and so on. Today, I think Danielle Smith called the increase immoral and inhumane. Why not heed those calls?
Well, Pierre Poilievre or Danielle Smith will never talk about the fact that as the price on pollution increases in Canada, so does the rebate that Canadians get. And 250 economists came out yesterday, the Parliamentary Budget Officer and a number of other experts have said that low-income to middle-income Canadians get more money back from carbon pricing than they pay. And those people who, the richest among us, who have a number of cars and a house and a cabin and who have lavish lifestyle will pay more in carbon pricing than they get back. But for most Canadians, the vast majority, they get more money back. And so, yes, the price on pollution is increasing April 1st, but the rebate that people will get also increases on April 1st. And it's somewhat ironic that Premier Smith would say that a 3 cents a liter increase on gasoline is immoral because of the price on pollution to fight climate change. She's just increased price on gasoline by 13 cents in Alberta, and people get no rebate for that.
Right. I mean, the PBO numbers have been hard. I think anyone out there who isn't either an economist, a politician, or an environmentalist has trouble digging through the PBO numbers because everyone uses them and throws them around in terms of whether or not people actually come out ahead or behind. It was interesting to see that you mentioned that report from the economics, sort of economists across the country. One of the things they did criticize was the carve-out for home heating oil, which happened a little earlier this year, or last year rather, when it came to applying the carbon tax. That would suggest that you're not inflexible when it comes to understanding the economic pain that this can inflict upon people. Why not do that again now?
The case for home heating oil was an exemption. I mean, the basic reason for putting a price on pollution, and it's something we've done in a number of other instances before, where some municipalities and provinces are doing it for waste. You pay for waste, so it's not free to send stuff in dump site anymore. We did it for acid rain with the United States in the late 80s, ozone depletion. So basically what you're doing is you're putting a price on something you don't want, which is climate change pollution, and incentivizing companies and people to change their behavior. What we found with home heating oil is that the majority, if not the vast majority of people who still use home heating oil in Canada are low income to low middle income Canadians who didn't have the money to make the switch to more energy efficient and less polluting form of heating their homes. So we decided to put a 3-year pause on that while putting in place programs to make it free in provinces that participate to the program, for people to make those switch so that people who don't have the money don't have to put any upfront costs to change their heating system. But the price on pollution will come back for home heating oil. And then those people who are using home heating oil will see their climate change rebate go down because the price on pollution is not being applied to home heating oil now. So it's not like, thanks to carbon pricing and the carbon rebate, people get more money back. If if we take that away, not only do we take away the best measure we have to fight climate change pollution, but we also take cold hard cash from people's pockets and at the time when they really need it. That's what's going to happen.
Right. I mean, I think one of the issues here is that, of course, people still do have to pay up front and wait for the money to arrive. And there's lots of debate around how the carbon tax itself filters through the system. I mean, it is meant to increase the price. It is meant to be a disincentive. So naturally, it means things, the cost of things will go up. It's meant to encourage people to stop using certain things and to shift towards others. But it seems to me that the carve out for home heating oil suggested that there was flexibility within this to recognize that affordability is top of mind for a lot of Canadians now. And rightly or wrongly, a lot of people believe, people who voted for you, people who supported you as well, believe that the carbon tax isn't helping. So please pause it. Did you support the carve out initially, just personally?
As the Prime Minister said when the announcement was made for home heating oil, he was very clear there will be no more carve-outs or changes to carbon pricing in Canada. Because, I mean, we spoke about this report that came out from 250 economists. There was another report that came out last week from the Climate Change Institute, which is an independent organization that shows that carbon pricing is the single most important thing that will enable Canada to achieve our 2030 climate change targets, pollution right. cuts targets. And the Parliamentary Budget Officer also recognizes that anything we do to fight climate change will come with a cost, and that putting a price on pollution, and I'm using his words, is the least disruptive way of doing that. So anything else we would do if we weren't doing that would come at a higher cost to Canadian taxpayers. So it's the most economically efficient way of doing it. Why not pause it? Because we can't pause climate change. And Canadians, Ben, whether they don't see it, they don't get it on a bill every month, but we are paying it. And it's costing us, according to insurance companies in Canada, 10 times more now than it was 10 years ago. So the cost of climate change to Canadians have gone from $200 million a year to $2 billion a year. And that's pre-summer of 2023. So we can expect that those costs last year went up even higher than $2 billion. And we're all paying for that, whether we like it or not, whether we see it on our energy bill or not.
It's interesting you mentioned that Climate Institute report, because it did, one of the things that was interesting about that report is it did find that the carbon tax on industrial emissions was far more effective, or at least a far greater part of those emission reductions than the consumer price. And it suggested perhaps that there could be a little bit of elasticity in on the consumer side that wouldn't have a huge impact on your attempts to cut greenhouse gas emissions, that you could in fact pause if need be, if you were convinced that it was needed.
I read that report and I would take a bit of a different view than on it. They've looked at eight measures and found that the number one measure, as you rightly point out, is the price that large industrial polluters are paying, but that the price that people pay at the pump and our Canadians on their energy bill is the fourth most efficient measure. And they've only looked at eight measures, but we've deployed more than 100 measures to tackle climate change in this country. And the price at the pump, carbon pricing at the pump or on energy bills, will help us to achieve about 10% of our overall targets. If there's a measure somewhere at no extra cost to Canadians, because it's revenue neutral, whatever the government collects, we send back to people, to municipalities, Indigenous nations, small, medium-sized businesses, that will enable us to achieve 10% of our target. Ben, as you know, I've been doing this for a very, very long time. And there are no other measures like that that can enable us to do that, where we don't have to put a higher burden on Canadian taxpayers.
Stephen Guilbeault is the Federal Minister of Environment and Climate Change. Minister, you just mentioned giving money back to small businesses. I gather there's a whole pile of money that they're waiting to get back. What's I mean, and that also sort of muddies the waters a bit when it comes to the whole idea of money going back and coming in. What's happened to that money? Why hasn't it gone back to the people who say they need it?
Oh, and they will get it back. And we've committed to return 100% of all the money that's collected through carbon pricing in the provinces where it's collected. It's not my department, not Environment and Climate Change Canada, mm-hmm. that's responsible for that. But the responsible departments are putting in place the necessary procedures to return the money to the small and medium-sized businesses as rapidly as possible.
Just on the politics side of this, Minister, I mean, I've always thought of the fight against climate change has to be, you sort of have to have collective buy-in, right? Because you're asking people to make sacrifices today to try and solve a problem that is long-lasting and so on. So the latest polling that's come out shows that, you know, I think it's two-thirds of Canadians cited carbon tax as an additional financial burden they can't afford. 40% saying it's costing them a lot. At some point, when a policy, regardless of how right you think it is, when it starts to lose public legitimacy, do you have to rethink it?
Well, first, I would take that poll you referred to with a bit of a big grain of
it's
salt.
It's a poll, indeed.
It was ordered by the Canadian Taxpayers Association, which is against pretty much everything government
right.
does.
Oh, this was the Angus Reid one. This was the Angus Reid one.
Yeah, but done for the Canadian Taxpayers the Taxpayers Association, number one. Number two, I think generally speaking, I would agree with you. You know, when you're in government, you want to try and do things that where you get buy-in from people. But there are times where, as governments, you must do difficult things, even if people are necessarily agree with you. It wasn't very popular when Jean Chrétien decided that we weren't going to be joining the United States with the war in Iraq. And he did so because he thought it was the right thing to do. It wasn't very popular when Brian Mulroney wanted to put in place the GST or wanted to negotiate a free trade agreement with the United States. In fact, the election following the adoption of those measures, the conservative government lost almost all of its seats. I don't think you would find a lot of people today. In fact, we saw with the death and the state funeral of Prime Minister Brian Mulroney, how today people see those measures as being very popular, despite the fact that they were very difficult politically to do at the time. So I think, right. generally speaking, I agree with you, but there are times where tough things must be done, and climate change is certainly one of them. And you know what, Ben, I speak to ministers from all around the world who are doing, like we are in Canada, their utmost best to fight climate change. And I've yet to find someone who's told me, oh, it's really easy for us. You know, it's a walk in the park to put in place right. necessary measures to fight climate change. It's a tough battle, but if we don't do it, then we give our kids and our grandkids a planet that will be in disarray. And as a father, I can't see myself doing that.
Right. I mean, you'll know the irony of mentioning what happened with Brian Mulroney in 1993 to where the polls are for you right now. I mean, it feels like, is this the political hot hill that the Liberal Party dies on? I mean, I think that's what it's coming to. Do you bend to what is sort of an outcry, or do you face the consequences? I mean, we saw what happened to the Progressive Conservatives in 1993. It was not, I mean, perhaps history has been a finer judge of it, but at the time it was a wipeout.
And we've decided that fought, as the Prime Minister said 2 weeks ago, we fought three federal elections where carbon pricing was not the only issue, but certainly one of them in 2015, 2019, and 2021. If we have to fight the fourth one next year in 2025, we will.
Stephen, thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure, Ben. Anytime.
Let's talk about housing. Renters in particular, about a third of Canadians, somewhere around 5 million households in this country are renters. I grew up in a rental household in part. I've been a renter and an owner over the years and a landlord and many other things. So I kind of understand the pressures of both of these things. And those numbers these days are disproportionately made up of those under 30. That'll be no surprise to people. Unless you're a long-standing tenant, you'll be feeling the squeeze of the rental market right now because vacancies are low and prices are just going through the roof. A March report found the average asking price for a rental unit in this country was nearly $2,200 a month in February. That's a 10.5% jump year over year. The report says asking rents in Canada have increased overall by a total of 21%, or an average of $384 per month from 2 years ago. Imagine that. That's just a huge jump. So it's no surprise that heading into the spring budget, which comes up on April 16th, and eager to stop a slide of the polls, the federal Liberals are making a pitch to renters, especially younger Canadians. The Prime Minister on Wednesday was in Vancouver teasing what's coming up in this budget. He says he's going to work with the provinces and territories to develop a renter's bill of rights. The new measure would also include, or new measures, a $15 million fund for provincial legal aid organizations that will help tenants fight rent evictions and landlord abuse. And they're also proposing a change to federal rules that make rental payments on time. Those who do will see that count towards their credit scores. Here's the Prime Minister.
We're announcing new protections for renters and new pathways to home ownership. As part of our upcoming budget, we're going to create a Canadian Renters Bill of Rights. It would create a nationwide standard for lease agreements, give renters a clear history of apartment pricing so they can bargain fairly, and make sure they have more agency. We're also going to launch a new legal aid fund that will protect tenants against unfairly rising rents, rent evictions, and bad landlords.
That all sounds pretty good on paper, doesn't it? But we thought we'd dig into this a little further to see if it's actually feasible, beneficial, workable, you name it. To help us answer those questions, Ron Butler is a mortgage broker at Butler Mortgages in Toronto, and he's a longtime observer of the real estate market, both when it comes to sales and rentals. Ron, thank you. Welcome back.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Now, you know, this budget's coming up. Obviously, the Liberals know that they're under fire from a significant portion of the population that feel like rent is too high or mortgages aren't affordable and so on. So out they come with this, which kind of sounds nice, sort of a renter bill of rights. But tell me how you see it. How do you see it from where you sit?
Well, first of all, the main thing is we should all remember the other famous bill of rights, the home buyer's bill of rights. They ran that one out just before our budget not too long ago. So the point then is the same as the point now. Almost none of these things are under federal jurisdiction. They're all provincial jurisdiction. You'll notice the language sometimes is, oh, well, we're going to get the provinces to cooperate. Well, guess what? You ran out your home buyer's bill of rights, and none of the provinces cooperated at all. So everything you proposed turned out to be completely false. There is no mandatory cooling off period. BC did go with a different version of one, but no other province did. There is no ban on blind bidding. There is absolutely no ban on multiple bids that are completely blind. The AREA, the provinces in Ontario, their Realtors Association said, well, it can be optional now. Like, they actually refused to let you do it before. They said, well, if the seller wants to, it's optional to reveal the other bids. So far, that's running about a half of 1%. Okay, so that didn't happen either. Oh, and by the way, the promise that you will have a home inspection for every single purchase. Well, I guess that never happened at all either anywhere in Canada. Okay, so all of those promises from the Home Buyer Bill of Rights. And then let's go back to this new Renter's Bill of Rights. Let's just run down the ridiculous items on each of them. And again, requires complete provincial cooperation. So let's start with a registry. Now, you got to admit, this federal government loves registries. Like, they love their registries. Like, you want to have a gun registry, we'll get blow through $1.6 billion on that one. Okay, but now they want a registry so that every landlord must reveal what their previous rents were when they offer a unit for rent. They have to tell you what the previous rents were. Again, no federal jurisdiction. The province has to agree.
Right. Not a terrible idea.
Right? Yeah. Not the worst idea. It does create another, you're going to have to hire a bunch of people and put a bunch of systems in place.
Indeed.
So yeah. That has to happen. But let's now think about it from this perspective. That thing might even be just lukewarm okay if there was a 6% vacancy rate. But it's less than 1% in most major cities in Canada. So what do you think if you went to your landlord and said, hey, landlord, look, you're offering this for $2,800 a month, this two-bedroom, but I see before you only offered it for $2,200 a month. I think you should come down quite a bit. And the reply of the landlord is, next. Okay, next. Like, you're out, dude. Like, I have 1% vacancy rate. You're out. We're not even talking about negotiation, okay? So that's ridiculous. At this moment in time, when there's 1%, less than 1% vacancy in major cities, that whole idea is just, it doesn't work. I mean, yeah, and you're going to spend a whole bunch of money to administer it. And by the way, It's a provincial jurisdiction, so they're not going to do it anyway. All right.
Yes, one of the things that you pointed out that was interesting was this whole notion around credit scores. Because to be honest, I didn't know my credit score had much to do with my mortgage, or maybe obviously it does to some extent, but I didn't even really quite understand what it is they were pitching here.
Sure, let me run it down. The idea is that the credit bureau system would be amended so that landlords would be required to upload information to the credit bureau about tenants paying perfectly on time, or unfortunately, probably even missing payments.
All landlords, like even mom and dad kind of thing?
Well, that's the ridiculousness of it. So that just proves to you how completely silly and just a political flag, a political theater taking place, that there is no way that the two credit bureaus in Canada could ever accept inputs from private individuals. I mean, that's a tremendous privacy potential. Like, they are so serious about data integrity at these two credit bureaus because it's vital. So how could they accept just mom and pop landlords uploading some information to them? There's not even a way to do it, quite frankly. There's no secure way to do it. So the other horrible thought is that while most landlords are fine, what about landlords that have a bone to pick with their tenant? And right. even though the tenant's paid on time, the landlord puts them down as being late. How do you check it? Right? So, this idea is literally crazy.
How about just the nuts and bolts of it? Because I suppose what they're trying to do here is they're trying to ease the transition from renter to owner. And I think all of us in life have done that transition. I've done that transition back and forth a few times, been both recently. Do people really get turned down from first-time mortgages based on their credit scores?
Possibly the best question, which the government never asked at all. Okay, the government keeps talking about millions of people who could be helped by this. Roughly, it's just less than 8% of all mortgage applicants are turned down on the basis of credit. So 92% are either approved or they just can't make the payments. They don't have enough income, so they're not approved on that basis. So credit only applies about 8% of the time. And of that 8%, there's only about 25% of the 8%, so let's call it 2%, that might have been helped if they had a highly positive landlord input into that credit score. And the nuts and bolts of it, as you said, are totally unworkable. There's no way in the world this system could be put together.
It's interesting because it sounds good. It does on paper. It sounds good. But when you start to dig into how it would actually work, I mean, Ron, as you well know, in your situation, you know, the barriers that exist now for renters trying to get into the housing market are pretty straightforward. There's not enough supply. What's out there is too expensive for most people to get onto the property ladder. And rents are going up, so they're having a harder and harder time saving unless there's some sort of, you know, windfall out there from mom and dad or who knows where. So, I mean, I just don't see how this helps any of that.
Ben, we got to get you into the Prime Minister's office. Okay, because you have summed this up. You have summed this up in the absolute precise way. The houses are too expensive, which creates the down payments being too large. The stress test, which is a federal government, that is at least a federal government rule, makes it harder for you to get a mortgage. So if you can find a mortgage at 5%, we're required to stress test you at 7%, which makes it even harder to qualify. And then where do you get in the down payment? Because your rents are so high, it's that much harder to save for down payment. I mean, it is literally a circle of destruction for which this idea gives no benefit. The idea of adding paid rent information to the credit bureau does not help anything you just described.
Ron Butler, a mortgage broker with Butler Mortgages, is with us this half hour. We're talking about the Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, announcing some measures yesterday that he hopes will protect Canadian renters. Obviously, rents are very high in this country right now, and help them into the housing market, where ultimately a lot of renters, not all, but a lot of renters would like to end up eventually or sooner than later at this point in time. Ron, if you look at this, then I suppose what is the right solution then? Because I don't know if a Bill of Rights, as you pointed out, jurisdictionally, this doesn't make much sense. Provinces are going to have to take care of the administrative burden of this, which they won't want to do. Some provinces already have pretty strong tenants' rights things. You know, there's already problems with tenants' rights and landlord rights. I mean, that's already a bit of a battleground. Where do you think the solution lies then in the near term to try and for a government to look like it's doing something, but to actually make a difference.
Well, if you wanted to give money, because another proposal is the creation of a $15 million fund for tenants to sue landlords. So I guess if you're in the landlord business, it's great news to find out that your prime minister is actually out gunning for you. Okay, that's, you'd be happy to hear that, right? Well, the prime minister wants to fund lawsuits against me. I'm a landlord. So that is an amazing concept of itself. But still, look, there are some bad landlords, but I would submit to you that the bad landlords are the minority. Most of them are decent people, just want to rent out a house or rent out a condo or strata unit. And that's fine. But when the government themselves stops and says, well, we think we really need to sue more of you, and that's coming from the federal government, that's why not just sell and get out of it? Like, just get out of it. Get out of it.
Aren't a lot of the problems with sort of the big companies? I mean, a lot of what I read, I mean, there are a few bad actors out there. Clearly, we read about them often enough. But in my experience, most landlords are just fine. Most landlords are small. They have a couple of units, maybe one. Maybe it's their home you're living in. But isn't part of the problem with the big, huge companies that have millions, you know, hundreds of thousands of properties? And you're not going to sue them, right? Are you?
Well, you can, but under the law of provinces, again, it's provincial jurisdiction. Almost all of those issues have to go to some kind of landlord and tenant board or tribunal. Right. And in the province of Ontario, for instance, by the way, it's bad in BC, but in the province of Ontario, the case backup is 53,000. Wow. They're behind 53,000 cases. So, you know, you want to send money to help fix tenants' problems and landlord problems so that landlords can, you know, be encouraged to have lower rents because they're not having some tenants not leaving for 10 months and not paying, send some transfers to the provincial governments where they are going to guarantee they go straight to hiring more people to fix these problems at the landlord and tenant board. Okay, like, let's get down from 26,000 from 53,000 down to 26,000. I mean, let's put the push on where it deserves to be pushed, but that's nothing that's going to happen. What's going to help to fix this? More supply. You know, it's funny. The federal government has an excellent program that will eventually help to deliver on the promise of supply for tenants. They have a program through CMHC that provides very affordable, efficient, very reasonable cost financing for multifamily units that are purpose-built rentals. They're all dedicated to rentals. And you have to have them a rental for a long time. You know, they come with requirements that it not be turned into a condo for a very, very long time. So it guarantees more rental stock. It's a well-accepted program. People are using it a lot. And the builders are using it to build more rental stock. Now, unfortunately, it takes, you know, between 2 and 6 years to get that done. But it's an excellent program. And for some reason, nobody's saying anything about it. That's the good program. In fact, expand it, encourage more builders and developers to use their own money to build more brand new, theoretically better, rental units for people at good financing rates and long amortizations so that you can pass those savings on to the renters. This makes a lot of sense, but we're not hearing anything about it.
No. So in a nutshell, then, on a scale of 1 to 10, how effective was this announcement yesterday, do you think, in helping Canadian renters sort of get some relief?
It's going to be as successful as the Home Buyers Bill of Rights, which was in the end, zero. None of it happened. Not one single thing happened. My prediction, for what it's worth, is that absolutely nothing that is proposed, other than the $15 million to sue landlords, they do an excellent job at throwing money at things. But in this case, I believe the outcome will be the same as the last time, and there will be zero change.
Ron, as always, it's good to get your insight on these things. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Ben.
There was this big settlement in the U.S. around the standard commission that realtors are paid there. There was a lawsuit. It was settled. Or at least they went to court, and there was a jury, and the organizations that were being pursued settled on this. And a real estate trade group there has agreed to a deal to drop what was once a cornerstone of the industry in the U.S. That is the 6% sales commission paid to agents, 6%. The rule changes, which are set to take effect this year in mid-July, really do represent a big change in the way agents there have operated going back to the 1990s. And it could really lead to home buyers and sellers negotiating lower commissions. Here is Michael Ketchmark. He was the lead attorney for the plaintiffs in that U.S. case.
is hitting the reset button on the housing market. And this is great for Americans, and this is great for homeowners.
Indeed. Now, on this side of the border, you'll know there are probably, depending where you live, there are different fee structures in different jurisdictions. In Ontario, for example, a commission of 5% of a home sales price is split between the buyer's and seller's agent. Well, in BC, it's 3 to 4% on the first 100 grand, 1 to 2% on the remaining balance. That's split 55-45, with the bigger part going to the seller's agent. Here, though, there are also some lawsuits that have been filed against various real estate bodies. And they want the courts to come to the same conclusion as they did in the U.S. and force a wholesale change in the way that realtors here charge their fees when a home is sold. Now, that lawsuit is yet to be, or lawsuits have yet to be certified, so it's not nearly as far along as the American lawsuit was. It essentially names a number of associations, brokerages, and others, and alleges that they've conspired to set fees and illegally drive up the price of real estate commissions in this country. If successful, UBC housing expert Tom Davidoff says it could have a real impact on the industry here as well.
Should this litigation work out in Canada, as in the U.S., I think we will see lower commissions that sellers pay. Buyers may be in a bit of a sticky position because they won't have agents working for them for free.
Indeed. I mean, part of this is that buyers get agents because they're going to get this commission if indeed the sale goes through. In a written response to Global News on this story, the Canadian Real Estate Association says, quote, there are different legal and factual circumstances between Canada's litigation and the matter in the United States. Canada's ongoing litigation is before the courts, and we will be reviewing their agreement, the U.S. one. Garth Myers is that litigator here with Toronto law firm Colloquian Myers. He's the one who filed the proposed Canadian class action suit, and he joins me now to explain. Garth, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
I suppose just to sort of start at the beginning for listeners to understand, wherein lies the issue here that prompted the class action, the proposed class action lawsuit?
On the sale of residential real estate. When you sell a house in Canada, the seller is responsible to pay the seller's own agent. Typically in Ontario, it's 2.5%. Elsewhere in Canada, that can vary. But the rules require the seller to also pay the buyer's agent's commissions, which is a bit funny and different from most transactions that we're involved in where we only pay for services that we use. Here, we're responsible for paying for services used by a different party. And how this comes into play is if you want to list your house on a multiple listing service, which is the dominant way in which you sell your house in Canada, you have to fill out a little box as the seller to make an offer of commission to the buyer brokerage. And in order for you to get your house up onto that marketplace, you've got to make that offer. Now, the way this whole works is when the seller is selling their house, they want to get the most money they can for their house. And so they offer a commission that will be attractive to buyer brokerages. So they'll show their house to their clients. And that way, they'll be more interested in your house, more bids on your house, and you'll get top dollar for the sale of your house.
Which makes sense, obviously. I mean, this is the way the system, I think most Canadians who've ever bought or sold a house would be familiar with this system. Wherein then lies the problem? I mean, you pointed out the oddity of having to pay not only a commission to the person responsible for selling your house for you, but also to the agent for the person buying it. You pointed out the oddity of that, but wherein lies the problem then?
The problem arises because the seller is encouraged or incentivized by these rules to put in an offer of commission that is higher than it should be. And the way it works is this. If I'm selling a house, I want to get, as I said, as many offers as possible on the house. And I want to put in the standard commission to buyer brokerages, because if I put a number in, an offer of commission to a buyer broker that's lower than the standard, then I'm susceptible to this phenomenon called steering, where buyer brokers will not show my property to their clients because the commission I'm offering them is lower than the norm. And so in over 99% of the cases in Ontario, it's a 2.5% offered to the buyer brokerage. And now we look at jurisdictions where these rules don't exist, where the seller doesn't have to make an offer of commission to the buyer's agent, and either buyer's agents don't exist at all, or the amount they get paid is a fraction of what they get paid in Canada.
Right, because this can add up to a lot of money. Let's be honest, with the price of housing now, if you're looking at commissions going both ways, even a split on 5% is an awful lot of money.
Well, that's the crazy thing. I mean, if you think about the rapid increase in housing prices in Canada, I mean, 15 years ago, when house prices were about a quarter of where they are today, the percentage being paid to the buyer broker was the same, but on an absolute basis, it was much lower. Think about what's changed over the last 15 years. Certainly technology has changed, and arguably the job of the buyer brokerage has been made a lot easier, because these days, if you want to buy a house, you're going on the internet, you're looking at houses yourself, you're doing a lot of the legwork yourself. But at the same time, because the buyer brokerage is being paid on a commission basis, the payments to them have gone up commensurate with the increase in housing prices. And so today they're getting 2.5% of, in Toronto, average house price is 1.2 million, which is an astounding amount compared to the amount of work that's actually done by buyer brokers.
Can you opt out? I mean, is it mandatory that that percentage be the percentage that you pay? Because I was obviously following what happened in the States. We could talk about that case because it mirrors what's going on with your proposed lawsuit in some ways, but that in fact, most buyers and sellers don't even know that, or sellers, I should say, don't even know that in the States that this was actually not a mandatory, that it was negotiable.
Yeah, I mean, certainly the one of the defenses we're going to see in this case is that, well, you know, you can actually offer whatever you want as a seller, but you know, you got to ask yourself, why is it that in 99% of cases, 2.5% is being offered? It's because these rules create a system of control on the price of buyer brokerage services. And so, you know, in theory, it's true. The reality is these are pretty strong forms of control that have increased the price of buyer brokerage services, especially over the past 15 years.
Tell me a bit about then who is ultimately, I think the Canadian Real Estate Association would be part of this, or amongst others, who is it that is then, in according to the proposed lawsuit, who is behind this then? Who's pulling the strings?
So we have two cases, one on behalf of sellers in the Greater Toronto area, and the second case is on behalf of everybody else in the country. And we've named as defendants three separate groups of participants. The first is your brokerages. So these are the folks that are employing agents and salespeople. Secondly, the big franchisors, the REMAXes, the Century 21s of the world. And then finally, the various real estate associations. And you've got one that's across Canada, the Canadian Real Estate Association. And then you've got local real estate associations across the country. And so those are the defendants against whom we're seeking compensation for these rules controlling the price of buyer brokerage services.
When you look at what just happened in the U.S., because I think that's been a lot of the interest, I know this proposed lawsuit was filed a while back. I guess what's happened in the U.S. Has put a lot of focus on what you're up to, because they're quite similar. Just as understanding of what's just happened in the U.S. in a very similar case.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, just by way of background, you're right that the case was very similar. The U.S. class action attacked an identical rule that operated in the States, and they took it all the way to trial in a jury ruled in favor of the class of the sellers and granted a verdict of in excess of $1 billion. And what's interesting is what happened after that. Instead of appealing, the National Association of Realtors in the States agreed to settle, and they agreed to pay hundreds of millions of dollars. But more importantly, from our perspective, is they agreed to walk away from these rules. And I say that's important because in the Canadian case, one of the main defenses that we expected the other side to advance was this argument that the rule requiring the seller to pay the buyer broker was necessary for the proper functioning of the system. It was reflective of the cooperation between all of the participants. And without that rule, the whole thing would break down. But the fact that the U.S. National Association of Realtors has now walked away from that rule, we think is proof positive that the rule is absolutely not a necessary component of the system, that the system can work without that rule. And therefore, we think to the extent that the Canadian defendants were going to rely on that as their primary defense, I think that's been completely eviscerated.
Garth Myers is a litigator with Toronto law firm Cloghi & Myers. He has filed a proposed class action lawsuit in federal court on behalf of plaintiffs who allege that various real estate associations in this country, as well as brokerages and so on, compete or conspired to set fees and illegally drive up the price of real estate commissions. Garth, I guess one of the interesting things here is that if you look at the way the system is built, this is a long-standing system, and I get the impression that the way this works with the commissions that are paid out and the seller both paying the commission for his own real estate agent or their own real estate agent and the buyers, and the way that this whole structure is set up, the associations depend on it too, because there's a bunch of money changing hands in here, and all of it kind of depends on the system existing the way it does. That was what emerged from the case in the U.S.
Well, that's exactly right. The reality is, in an industry like residential real estate, where you have fairly low barriers to entry. I mean, you know, your Uber driver is a real estate agent, your hairdresser is a real estate agent. Who's benefiting from the proliferation of real estate agents? It's two groups. It's the franchisors who are getting fees for setting up new franchises. And it's the real estate associations who are getting paid on a per member basis. And so when you inflate the cost of real estate commissions, new entrants will come into the market. You've got in the greater Toronto area, you've got in excess of 60,000 real estate agents competing for real estate. And the reality is the market shouldn't be able to withstand that sort of competition. It only exists because of these inflated fees. Right. And I think if we're successful in this lawsuit, you'll see fewer real estate agents and you know, who's going to suffer. It's going to be the associations and the franchisors probably.
Right. What is the timeline on this then? Because I gather it's proposed. So for just on the legal side of things, where do you stand? I think a lot of people look at what's happened in the States and wonder what stage are these ones at?
Well, I would say the wheels of justice move slowly in Canada, but they do move. We're still at a preliminary stage in the cases. We're likely to be in the Federal Court of Appeal on a preliminary motion to strike later this year, where we're arguing about whether these cases plead tenable claims at law. After that, we'll move towards the motion for certification. And then after that, if we're successful, move to trial. And I expect that to roll out over the next few years.
Not to ask you to act in the role of your opponent here, but what will be the defense then? You mentioned already that the rules, the way they are set up, are sort of integral. But the fact that the American Association agreed to get rid of the rules kind of undermines that argument. But what would be the main arguments against what you're saying here?
The primary argument we've seen so far is that the law in Canada under the Competition Act is narrower than what's covered in the States. And so the defendants in our case will argue, you know, even if all of this is true, it's still not illegal under Canadian law. And that's what we're arguing now about in court. And we expect to overcome that and prove that, in fact, this is illegal conduct. This is illegal conduct under the Competition Act. And I think a lot of what's going to drive that is this growing view from the public that, in fact, these rules are totally unnecessary and that they do inflate the cost of buyer broker services. And they're really impacting the Canadian public. And I really hope that the court reaches the same conclusion.
It's interesting to look at just the whole MLS system. I think most people are familiar with it. It remains one of the closed systems, sort of, in an era when there's so much open information and competition out there. The fact that you have to go through those systems seems to be the golden goose here.
I think that's exactly right. I mean, we look at industries that used to exist under that format, like, you know, travel agents and other intermediaries. And in all of those industries, technology has advanced to the point where you don't need them anymore, you know, or they've been significantly reduced or they've been constrained to very special situations. But because the real estate industry has such a stranglehold on the buying and selling of real estate, they've really been able to control the mechanism through which we do it. And that's as a result of their sort of legacy. Technological advances should have eliminated that. But through, you know, hook or by crook, they've managed to keep it going. And I think if our lawsuit is successful, it'll play a big part in dismantling at least some part of that for the benefit of homeowners.
Right. And we already have a bit of a window into what that might look like because of what's just happened in the US, I think it's hard to understate what's just happened.
Yeah, that's precisely right. With the elimination of the rule or the agreement of the National Association of Realtors to eliminate the rule requiring sellers to pay buyer brokerages, a fundamental part of the problem, I think, has been fixed there. And although it's not immediate, and I think, you know, we've hired some very smart economists to help us with their case, they think that you'll see reductions in commission over time. In other words, this isn't something that will happen overnight. But I think the same would hold true if this happened in Canada. In other words, if the Canadian Real Estate Association agreed tomorrow to eliminate those rules, we would see a decrease over time in those commissions.
Well, Garth, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, Ben.
The governor of Maryland today warned that it's going to be a very long road ahead to recover from the loss of the Francis Scott Key Bridge. Again, the collapse happened Tuesday when that, we believe, powerless cargo ship struck a pillar supporting the bridge. Governor Wes Moore says divers recovered the bodies of two men in a pickup truck near the bridge's middle span yesterday.
We are thinking about the families of Dolian Castillo Cabrera and Maynard Suazo Sandoval, who were recovered and identified yesterday. We pray for the family and the families of all of the victims.
Again, a tragedy. I mean, in watching it happen, you thought, people are gonna die. People are gonna lose their lives. The governor also says that they're working really hard on plans to clear the debris, move the cargo ship that rammed into the bridge, recover the bodies of the four remaining workers presumed dead, and obviously investigate what went wrong.
This work will not just take weeks. We have a very long road ahead of us. We understand that, and we're preparing.
So while the search for answers and the cleanup continues following the disaster on Tuesday, this is something I wanted to talk about tonight, because obviously when it happened, I was awake, I was watching, following social media, stayed up actually quite late looking for people to talk to about it the next day, woke up to it again, followed it very closely. And, you know, there was a time where, even not that long ago, where a lot of what you'd see on social media was sort of news feeds and people sort of just reporting what had happened, talking about what expertise they maybe you'd see engineers talking. And I did. There were all kinds of interesting opinions being shared on social media early Tuesday morning and into Wednesday morning, or into early Tuesday morning and then after sunrise. But a quick scan, even in the hours right after that cargo ship slammed into the bridge, you would have landed on any number of people who claim to know, who already know what happened, or at least they were theorizing and throwing some pretty wild theories out there. Why wait for an investigation or pay heed to law enforcement officials who said that quickly the next day or later that day, that there was absolutely no indication that this was anything nefarious that had been done on purpose, for instance. But lots of people popped up spreading conspiracy theories and baseless rumors almost immediately. It was like this entire alternate reality had been created around the bridge's collapse. And here's what I find awful about that is because, this, you know, I understand, listen, we kind of live in a wild information universe and people could follow who they want on social media and so on. But there's a certain amount of responsibility here when people die, when these things have these horrible things happen. And we're all a bit traumatized by them, or at least a bit taken aback by them. So of course we're seeking out information about it. And it makes us so vulnerable to those who would just talk junk, mostly to build their own brands, right? I mean, there were all kinds of ones about, you know, here are some of the ones that I saw. A cyber attack. I mean, that wasn't completely ridiculous, but it seems improbable. That one came out. Lots of people saying this had to be, you know, something that had been done in advance. It was some kind of thing that had been orchestrated. The ship's captain was suffering from the side effects of the COVID-19 vaccine. Claims that Israel or even the Obamas had something to do with the bridge's collapse. There was talk about open borders, about diversity, equity, and inclusion, on and on and on and on and on. So I thought I'd call Mike Rothschild, who's a researcher and a journalist who's written books about QAnon and other conspiracy theories, because he's been looking into this. He follows it closely. His latest book is called Jewish Space Lasers, The Rothschilds and 200 Years of Conspiracy Theories, and he joins me now. Mike, thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me back.
I was up to watch the early video of the Key Bridge collapsing, and it was jaw-dropping. I mean, I think most of us just sat there thinking, what could have gone wrong? And yet, by the time I woke up, about 6-7 hours later, social media was already flooded with theories that I thought couldn't possibly be true.
Yeah, it happened immediately. Because this happened in the middle of the night on the East Coast, and I think by the time people woke up, I mean, certainly for me on the West Coast, I woke up and I saw that there was already a large scale infrastructure of conspiracy theories about what had really happened. And of course, a lot of them were contradictory and they couldn't all have been true, but, you know, people ran with the stuff that was best for the personal brand that they have, which is the kind of cynicism that we've seen in the conspiracy community over the last few years.
Yeah, what amazed me about it, I guess, now is just the speed with which it happens. And, you know, this tragedy is not alone. There have been others where people pile in pretty quickly. But there seems to be almost a template that each person, and these are people with millions of followers, there seems to be almost a template, a worldview with which they see every one of these incidents, regardless of what it is.
Right. They automatically believe that whatever they're seeing is either fake or was planned as part of some deep state operation, or is taking place because of some social issue that they've been talking about a lot. The details of it are going to vary based on the people, But the thing they have in common is that what we are seeing cannot possibly be an accident, because things like that, quote, don't just happen. When, of course, things like that do happen all the time. You know, if you go to Wikipedia, there's a whole page of bridge incidents, and at least a dozen of those are ship colliding with bridge. It's not that uncommon. So there's really no need for an explanation outside of it was an accident. But these people thrive on finding the real reasons why things happen. And of course, it can't just be an accident, because that's not good for their brand.
Right. But when I was looking at some of the ones out there, some of the more ridiculous, I mean, there were many ridiculous ones. The anti-vax ones were particularly ridiculous.
I knew immediately somebody was going to blame it on the COVID vaccine. And of course, somebody did.
Indeed. And DEI, you know, diversity, equity, and inclusion. That was right. The other one that came out, any sort of wokeism thing. The cyber attack one is the one that really caught on, because even listeners to my show have been texting. And I think people were really wondering how a ship of that, you know, relatively new ship of that size could have such a catastrophic failure. So, of course, even though it was, I guess, Andrew Tate and Alex Jones and so on who were spreading that one, you know, at least that seemed to be rooted in some sense of maybe plausible.
Right. That was the one, the cyber attack scenario is the one that had the most inherent believability. I mean, I don't think most people look at a bridge accident and go, wow, DEI did that. But, you know, you watch a big ship and its power goes out and it starts drifting, and you start to think, well, how could a big ship's power go out? Well, things have their power go out without cyber attacks all the time. But we have kind of, you know, embraced this idea that we are in this kind of endless kinetic war, and our adversaries have this ability to turn on and off the power of anything they want to. So you understand why people would leap to cyber attack. It's just that the evidence very quickly came in that it was not a cyber attack, and it was just the power going out.
Yeah, I suppose the big appeal here for everyone jumping in is just knowing how many eyeballs are on this topic. There are few things that everyone in America, or everyone in North America, or even beyond that, we'll be looking for information about at the same time. And the bridge incident is another reminder of one of those incidents.
Yeah, we really don't have that kind of monoculture where everybody is talking about the same thing very much anymore. And sometimes it happens where it's a really outlandish thing, like Kate Middleton, you know, supposedly disappearing or something like that. But with this bridge incident, we have this very bizarre accident happening. We've got a ton of footage of it happening right away. So you immediately have something where people are going to be talking about it. People are going to be wondering what happened. And a lot of people are going to look at something like that and say, it's surreal. It looks like a movie. That's not supposed to happen. And when you have something like that take place, it is an instant petri dish for conspiracy theories.
Yeah, I mean, I don't disagree. The first time I watched it and I saw it sort of happen, some of the early videos that were posted, it did look unreal. I mean, it did look like something that had been created by CGI or something. I mean, as you begin to see the difference, I mean, quickly you begin to realize what it is, but just the speed with which the bridge collapsed and so on. So I can see there were a lot of people who were sort of stunned by what they were looking at and wanting to find answers fast. I don't question so much maybe the gullibility or the curiosity of those who share or read or see. What I'm always interested in, what's in it for the influencers? Because clearly it's not just about sharing an idea. You know, maybe they genuinely believe it was due to diversity, equity, and inclusion. Who knows? But there's a cynicism here that's happening too, that I think, given, especially when it comes to a tragedy like this one where people have died, that there's a cynicism there that's kind of hard to swallow.
Yeah, it's very cynical. It completely disregards the actual deaths of the people who were on the bridge. And it also disregards the heroism of the ship's pilot, who we now know was able to radio in and say, I've lost power, I'm about to hit the bridge, close the bridge. And it saved many more people who would have died if this had been some sort of like sudden cyber attack and, you know, it was a deep state plot. We disregard the actual human stories in these things in favor of fanciful tales that we want to be true. And what's in it for the people who are pushing these stories is that it's part of their brand. You know, for a person like Alex Jones, for a person like Andrew Tate, they're not somebody who their fans expect to look at something like that and go, it's a tragic accident. The expectation from their fan bases is they're going to tell me what really happened. And it's going to be outlandish. It's going to be bizarre. There's going to be somebody that we can blame for it. what is in it for them is just the continuation of the same thing that they've been doing in many cases, somebody like Alex Jones, for decades. They look at something and tell you what they think really happened. And that's never going to be what actually happened.
Mike Rothschild is a journalist and author of Jewish Space Lasers, The Rothschilds and 200 Years of Conspiracy Theories. We're talking about all the conspiracy theories that have been floating around since not long after the bridge in Baltimore hit the water on Tuesday night. Unfortunately, we know that six people have died in that. It could have been much worse. There was the heroism of the ship's captain, as Mike was talking about just a little bit earlier, in alerting authorities so police could stop traffic on that bridge. I suppose, as you said, it's a petri dish. I saw someone else refer to it as a canary in a coal mine. Another reminder of what the information, you know, ecosphere is like, or environment is like, as we head into an election coming up, you know, pretty soon now.
Yeah, this is what we have to look forward to, is probably the wrong term, but this idea of weaponizing tragedies and accidents and incidents to move things along in the direction that we want them to, it is entirely based on your own political persuasion at this point. What you are telling people happened, we're basically running everything that happens through a filter of our own beliefs.
And it's been interesting to watch elected officials do it as well. Because it's one thing, I mean, I think people understand who Alex Jones is, I think people understand who Andrew Tate is. There are many others out there. But for elected members of Congress to be throwing out ideas of, you know, conspiracy theory ideas around tragedies that, and let's be honest, they should unite, and politicians should be there to help unite, or at least err on the side of caution and err on the side of truth.
Yeah, you have many politicians who have now made this kind of conspiracism their brand. You know, this kind of spreading of these theories is something that their constituents expect, something that their Fox News fans expect. You know, somebody like Ted Cruz, who spends probably as much time shilling for his podcast as he does actually legislating. So by embracing these things, it's a brand extension for a lot of these politicians as well. It's another way for them to push back at the liberal agenda, push back at Biden, push back at wokeism, or whatever it is that their fans are expecting. It's all just a brand extension.
I should mention that while we see it mostly on one side, it's not, you know, there are other people on the political spectrum that aren't immune to this sort of thing, maybe just not for this kind of an event.
Oh, sure. And one of the things I talk and write about a lot is that nobody is immune to conspiracy theories. There are, you know, conspiracy theories are not a just a matter for conservatives, for Republicans. Everybody, no matter what your political persuasion is vulnerable to the right piece of disinformation if it hits them in the right way at the right time. And that can be political, it can be medical, it can be social, can be about anything. We're all susceptible to somebody telling us something that's not true and us believing it.
It is when someone sees something, especially when something is so visual. I mean, the collapse of the bridge, not to put it too fine a point on it, but it reminded me of the collapse of the Twin Towers in some small way. The void it left on Baltimore's landscape, I had one person tell me this week, reminded them of the Twin Towers no longer being there. And it reminded me back, it took me back to 9/11. And I was thinking, these sorts of events now used to be times where there was sort of a collective sense of tragedy and loss. And now it's something different. And I don't want to compare what happened in Baltimore to 9/11 for too long. But I was thinking about the sense of collective loss and the collective search for truth has changed very much now. And it's changed in a way that within hours, people have different views about what happened.
Oh, sure. The conspiracy theories come out of traumatic events. And, you know, certainly the bridge collapse is not the scale of trauma that 9/11 was, but it's a similar kind of thing. You're watching a landmark be destroyed. You're watching people die. And for many people, there is a need for truth, obviously, but also to blame it on something. And if you go back and you listen to the output of some of the biggest conspiracy theorists of, you know, 2001, if you listen to somebody like Alex Jones, if you listen to somebody like Bill Cooper, the author of the seminal conspiracy theory book, Behold a Pale Horse, who had a radio show up until his death, actually was just after 9/11, it is within a half an hour that they're claiming that the towers were brought down by controlled demolitions. It couldn't have been terrorists. Whatever the media is going to tell us is a lie. But that was still kind of a fringe corner of a kind of far-right infotainment. Most people were not dialed into that. Most people were not looking for that in the hours after 9/11. Now we're in a position where everybody's looking for that. Everybody's looking to see, well, who did this? What's What's our pet theory? Who are we going to believe about this one? I think it really is demonstrative of how our society has embraced fringe beliefs and conspiracy theories, and sharing them, even if we don't believe them, we share them simply to gawk at them and make fun of the people who do believe this stuff. And unfortunately, it just spreads them to more people.
Yeah. And part of it, too, is truth takes time. So if your answer to watching that bridge collapse is, let's wait to see what the NTSB has to say in their first report, preliminary report out in 6 months, let's let the investigation unfold, that isn't as interesting as it was a cyber attack. And I get that. I get that.
Right. We love stories and we love villains. And if a bridge collapses and the villain is, bad luck or a weird sequence of events that we could have just as easily fallen victim to, that is not as satisfying as it was done to us by someone we don't like.
Indeed. Mike, as always, thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone. Like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.